You're listening to NPR on Science. I'm David Malikoff, a science reporter and editor here at the NPR Mothership in Washington. And I picked out four stories for you this time. It's a pretty eclectic mix. Some bird brains, a disease that could threaten your Wheaties, a cloud of computers. Think about that for a minute. And finally, a solution to climate change that you might not have thought of, the busy beaver. First, I want to talk about a little yellow and black bird that I saw out of my window the other day. It's a warbler called a yellowthroat, and it was on migration. It was heading north up to its nesting grounds. Exactly how birds navigate during migration is one of those mysteries that lots of scientists have tried to solve. Now my colleague Joe Palka tells me that there may be a chemical in that little yellowthroat's brain that acts like a compass. Here's his story.
Peter Hoare is a physical chemist at the University of Oxford in England. He appears in this story because he has a very particular research interest.
All my research life, I've looked at magnetic effects of various sorts in chemistry.
It turns out that certain chemicals act a bit like magnets. About a decade ago, Hoare became intrigued by the suggestion that there might be a chemical reaction that was so sensitive to magnetic effects that it could even detect the extremely weak magnetic field of the Earth. So he began looking for just such a reaction, and as he and his colleagues write in the current issue of their journal Nature, they think they found one. It's a reaction based on a chemical that's similar to one found inside a bird's eye. Now that's an important point because Hoare says experiments with birds show that light appears to be essential for a bird's magnetic sense to work.
There is a requirement for blue light. Without blue or green light, the birds can't use their compass.
The theory that birds have this kind of chemical compass has been around for 40 years. Torsten Ritz is a physicist by training. He's at the University of California at Irvine. He proposed a theory 8 years ago that attempted to explain how this chemical compass would work.
There are lots of theoretical speculations out there and arguments why this should work in principle.
But Ritz says it's one thing to have theories. What Hoare and his colleagues have done is provide data.
This is the first study that actually shows that there are Earth-strength magnetic field effect on a photochemical reaction. And so that's the big contribution here.
Ritz says Peter Hoare has not found a chemical reaction that exists in birds, just a chemical reaction that could exist in birds. And Ritz says Hoare and his colleagues have only shown that the reaction responds to magnetic fields in the laboratory.
Now that is, of course, different from the question of saying, is this actually what's happening in an organism? And that requires completely different tests in some sense.
But Ritz says those tests can and will be carried out. Ritz has actually done some of the tests on how robins navigate, and the results are encouraging. He says research on how animals perceive magnetic fields has become extremely exciting recently.
And it's not every day that you can work on discovering a new sense. You know, like when you look around, we know pretty much a lot about vision, hearing, and smell, and so on. And the magnetic sense is really one of these big mysteries.
But it's a mystery that scientists are getting closer to solving. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, Joe, maybe one mystery down, but there are still a lot more out there. Recently, Steve Inskeep, one of the voices of Morning Edition, talked to a computer guru about a very cool idea for solving problems. It involves hooking up a whole cloud of computers.
Maybe you could think of it this way. If you need more electricity for your house, you don't go to the store and buy some, you just flip a switch. If you need a more powerful computer, you could do the same thing. Instead of buying a new model, you click the mouse. That's one concept anyway, among several we'll discuss with Craig Boulding. He is an IT security expert at a Fortune 500 company. The company doesn't want its name disclosed because it's sensitive about security, but he is talking with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Would you explain this concept, which I gather goes by the name cloud computing, which immediately sounds a little cloudy to me?
Yes, and it is unfortunately a bit cloudy. Everybody has a slightly different definition of it. In general, though, there are certain themes that come out. One of them is this concept of grid computing and utility computing. Now, these are grand terms that really just mean that you have a lot of standard PCs working together in unison trying to crack through the workload.
Well, what are some other jobs that I might be able to have done with this system if I've got my not-so-great computer in front of me but a great internet connection?
Well, Steve, I understand that you have a passion for genealogy.
well, my wife's a genealogist, yes.
Well, then there's a definite passion there. Part of that obviously involves cracking the DNA and trying to figure out the links between people. So using a supercomputer that's available to you in the cloud is something that you'd be able to do with that.
I could do DNA analysis on my home computer by renting somebody's amazing computer 1,000 miles away?
Exactly. Your home computer really just becomes a display unit rather than actually processing. So all the grunt work gets done inside the cloud, but the updates to your screen get sent down to whatever terminal you're using.
Does this mean if I need extra memory to store a bunch of photographs and I don't have it on my machine, I can just go online and quickly get that memory someplace else to store things?
Yes, you would just turn a dial, and as long as your credit card number is with them and they can bill you for that extra space you're going to take, you can have it there and then. There's no going out to the store.
You just mentioned an important thing, a credit card number. So this is almost like I'm renting storage space for the extra stuff that doesn't fit in my house.
That's exactly it. You're just basically, you know, paying by the drink.
Instead of buying a whole new bottle, okay. Let me ask about another implication, though. Is somebody who runs a business who used to have a filing cabinet or a filing room and then had computer files and computer databases really going to be able or want to take the risk of shipping all their files out to some random computer they don't even know where it is and paying to rent storage that way?
Yes, and that's really a key question. Even though, you know, these are reputable companies, many of them, there's going to be a whole kind of ecosystem that builds up around this of smaller companies that will offer additional services on top of those kind of base services. And so what I've done is I've actually started up a blog, cloudsecurity.org, and what I'm trying to do is get the various cloud providers to come and have a discussion about what security you're doing. Now, obviously, they're not going to be revealing their blueprints, and nor am I asking them to, but there's certainly some steps that can be taken to the point before you get disclosing your intellectual property.
Craig Balding is an IT security expert. He's got a blog about cloud computing called cloudsecurity.org.
My guess is that cloud computing won't be much help in solving the problem in this next story. It's by Dan Charles, and it's about a fungus that's killing wheat all over the world. As you listen to this story, here are a couple of things to think about. One is that before he was a radio journalist, Dan Charles was a farmer. He grew up on a dairy farm in Pennsylvania, and so he brings some real firsthand experience to his reporting on agriculture. Second is, I want you to listen closely for a guy named Ronnie Kaufman. He's an agricultural scientist in this story. But I got to admit, the first time I heard the story, all I could think was, Elvis Presley is alive and well and working in science. Here's Dan.
The great enemy of wheat, ever since people started growing it thousands of years ago, is a fungus called stem rust. Hans Braun, director of the wheat program at the International Center for the Improvement of Wheat and Maize in Mexico, says rust epidemics came and went.
The last stem rust epidemic the United States experienced was in the mid-50s, and they lost about 40% of their spring wheat.
But in the 1960s, scientists, plant breeders, came to the rescue. They found wheat plants that could fend off stem rust, and they bred the wheat resistance genes from those plants into wheat varieties that farmers could plant all over the world. Ronnie Kaufman, who's in charge of international agricultural projects at Cornell University, says for 40 years, farmers didn't have to worry about this fungus.
But that lasted so long that, you know, that people became complacent.
In 1998, though, in a small plot of wheat in Uganda, researchers noticed something disturbing. Stem rust, attacking plants that were supposed to be resistant to it. The next year, it was confirmed. A new race of stem rust had emerged.
And now everybody realizes that we really have to get back to business here.
Cornell's Ronnie Kaufman says wheat fields everywhere are vulnerable. The wind can blow fungus spores hundreds of miles. Last year, the new form of stem rust leaped from Africa across the Red Sea to Yemen. This spring, it was detected in Iran, a big step closer to the breadbasket of Asia in Pakistan and India.
Everybody in the path of this thing who depends on wheat has to be worried.
There is hope. Wheat breeders have tested their vast collections, and they've found some varieties that seem to withstand the new race of stem rust. Pakistan, India, and many other countries now are testing those varieties, growing as much as they can, collecting the harvest for farmers to use as seed. Hans Braun from the International Wheat Research Center in Mexico says it will take 5 years or more before enough seed is available. But no one knows how quickly the fungus will spread and when it will cause an epidemic.
It's very difficult to predict. It could happen next year if the conditions are favorable. It could take 10 years. It's very difficult to say, but once the conditions are right, then it will spread like a bushfire.
Experts on wheat say this is the most urgent seed breeding campaign they've seen in a generation. But they say some governments, including the U.S. government, don't seem to recognize the urgency. This year, the United States cut its funding for international agricultural research centers, such as the one in Mexico, by about half. Budgets also are being slashed at the USDA laboratory that works specifically on stem rust in St. Paul, Minnesota. The stem rust campaign has turned to private funders, and last month they got $26 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. A local farmers' union in Mexico threw in another $500,000. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
I love the idea in that story that small farmers in Mexico are actually helping pay for the research that could solve their wheat rust problem. Now, here is one of the little guilty pleasures of getting to do this podcast. I get to include one of my own stories. Earlier this year, I met a very interesting biologist named Mary O'Brien. And when she told me about one of the projects she was working on, I got really intrigued. The idea is to restore beavers to some streams in the American Southwest where they haven't been for a long time. The hope is that the dams they build will help conserve water in an area that's supposed to get a lot drier due to climate change. Here's my story. Southern Utah does not look like beaver country. Lots of rocks, not many trees, but climb down into a canyon and you can find water. Clear, cool water. This is Deer Creek near the town of Boulder. Once there were lots of beavers here. Then, about 100 years ago, the fur trappers came. They killed the beavers and took their pelts. In fact, the trappers were so thorough that by the mid-1800s, the beavers had virtually disappeared. Now, biologists want to bring them back.
If I'm a beaver, I want a not-too-steep stream.
Biologists like Mary O'Brien. She works with the Grand Canyon Trust, and she knows a lot about beavers.
And I want kind of gooey mud to put up on my sticks, and then I'm happy.
Believe it or not, O'Brien says that in a warming world, beavers could be a big help.
We're clearly facing climate change, less water, warmer water, water coming down in heavy storms when it does come down. And if we can get some of the best hydrological engineers on Earth for free, it's the perfect timing.
Climate scientists predict that this part of Utah will get a lot drier. And O'Brien says beavers could help keep the water flowing by doing what they do naturally, building dams.
Now, for them, it's a way of hiding from predators. For us, it's a way of slowing water down, recharging aquifers,
and making the water last longer into the summer. The idea is that the dams would hold back the snowmelt that runs off the mountains each spring, giving the water time to soak into the ground.
Beavers actually turn the mountain into a sponge for the water. Instead of a boom-bust, water in the spring, gone in the summer. It's water slower, but all the time.
Studies from other parts of the country have shown that restoring beavers can improve water supplies. But the strategy does have some problems. For one, beavers can become giant swimming pests. They dam up irrigation canals and road culverts, flooding out gardens and driveways. Some places even have special crews that trap and move nuisance beavers. But that doesn't bother Tom Hoyt. He owns a ranch along Deer Creek, and he says he'd be happy to take on some beavers that other people don't want.
There's a lot of beaver that need a place to go. I mean, it's almost like the Humane Society, if you will. There is a source, for sure.
But before any beavers can get moved, Hoyt says his neighbors along Deer Creek may need to be reassured. Farmers just downstream want to be sure that they'll get their water when they need it. And just upstream is a big national forest that gets lots of visitors. Robert McWhorter runs the Dixie National Forest. He says, yeah, beavers can be a nuisance, but they're also really cheap labor.
Beavers can help us do an awful lot of management for a pretty small cost, you bet.
He says besides saving water, beaver dams create great habitat for trout, insects, and birds. Today, McWhorter has come out to Deer Creek with Mary O'Brien, the biologist, and some local environmentalists. They're looking at places where beaver might be transplanted. As they get near the end of the walk, they find a surprise. They jump across Deer Creek.
One, two, okay, here I come. Thank you. All right.
And there, sticking up out of the grass, are willow shoots. They look like they've been lopped off by a machete.
Beaver do that. That's their thing. I think one of the beavers in here.
Sure enough, here's a willow stem that's been cut off just neat as can be. And you can actually feel the ridges that were made by the beaver's teeth.
We found something. That's way cool. That's way cool.
It seems these beavers didn't need a helping hand to find Deer Creek. The biologists say they probably moved up from somewhere downstream. But the beavers may need some help if they want to stay. Mary O'Brien notes that Utah still allows trappers to kill as many beavers as they want.
All can go for naught if you get beaver restored on, say, Deer Creek, and then one trapper comes in and cleans it out.
She and her allies are now working with the state to develop some new rules that would give beavers a little more protection. David Malikoff, NPR News. By the way, just because some beavers have come back to Deer Creek by themselves doesn't mean the reintroduction project isn't going ahead. In fact, Mary O'Brien told me that they're hoping to release some beavers this summer. That's it for NPR on Science. For more stories on science, technology, and the environment, go to npr.org. I'm David Malikoff.